Welcome to Power, Strength and Vulnerability, the Mental Health Podcast. It's time to make mental health a normal conversation with your host, Shane Kelton.
Welcome back to Power, Strength, Vulnerability, the podcast. We've had a little break. Looks like we'll have five or six guests over the next couple of months, raring and ready to go. Today, I have a young man with me who has inspired me in a way because you don't hear a lot of stories like his in terms of falling to where you fell to and then getting back up so productively and wanting to help others. So today, I welcome Riley to the podcast.
Hey, guys.
How nervous are you?
Yeah, very.
we just spoke prior to coming on air that we had, when we first met, we had the conversation and you were completely fine.
Yeah.
And I guess that was probably when most people would probably judge you, whereas now we've like talked heaps, shared our love, all that kind of stuff. But I just wanted to paint a picture for the audience listening. On the person that I met first, it was on a Friday.
Yep.
It's one of my first days working here. So for those listening, Riley works at the Power In You project. And the first thing I noticed, and I'm not going to shy away from that, was the ankle bracelets around your ankles. And what I gleaned from there is, so my instinct was, oh, this person's done something really wrong. But then it was like, hang on a minute, that's my instinct. What do I want to learn out of this and how can I help the situation? Because what I saw was a young man who was clearly looking to improve his life. And we had a really, I thought personally, a really good conversation, which has definitely stuck out to me and allowed me to change my perception on a few things as well. What's your recollection?
Yeah, so it was my first day down here as well. And yeah, I was a bit nervous and I guess the bracelets were out at that point.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I definitely, coming into an environment like Power In You, I definitely didn't feel judged. Where walking down the street was a hell of a lot of a different story. Yeah.
So I guess we're painting a picture of where, in a way, where you're at now, but we'll delve deeper into that later.
Yeah.
I know probably a lot of more of your story than I do a lot of the people, through our conversation, through seeing you talk and through chatting to other people at work about you. And, you know, for you, before you get to the loss that I guess saw you spiral, what was your life like growing up?
It was pretty good. Like, it wasn't poverty or nothing. It was more like low socioeconomic family. I had things that I needed and stuff like that. Loving family, always played sport throughout childhood. Went to primary school halfway through high school. I finished year 10, started like a pre-apprenticeship in mechanics, went on to then working two jobs at Subway whilst working full-time making timber roof trusses. Yeah.
So, like, essentially, like, pretty... we probably understand. Look, you understand it more than I do, but we both see the low associate, not economic. with what we do for work, I mean, considering all of that, you were set up pretty well in life.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
At the age of 16, I mean, your worst news probably came to you. What was that? And how did that transpire?
So I'll just go a little bit back before 16. So maybe from the age of 12, dad was really, really ill. And from about the age of 12 onwards, pretty much the doctor said, like, get ready. And then, it got to a point where he was, gone. He went longer than expected and it was great. But just to see the most like strongest, hardest man in my eyes become the most brittle and weak, crumble, like, to the point where he'd cry pretty much getting out of his seat because he was in that much pain, and just seeing the frustration and anger on him not being able to do the things that he could really took its toll. And then, when I was 16, unfortunately, he passed away. And, after that, my life just came crashing down, just spiraled. from, I guess, from the age of 16, just didn't know where to find myself. I lost my identity, really. Tried to become, per se, the man of the house, which was more pressure that didn't work. That led to drinking from young age. I used to be able to go down to the local supermarket. The Asians there would just sell it to me because they wanted money in their back pocket. So it was so easy to get. And then, yeah, it ended up being turning to drug use. And this probably went on until the age of 19, I reckon. Just, yeah, spiraling down, partying, clubbing, drugs and alcohol.
Like, on reflection, and, like, thank you, thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
On reflection, through that period where your dad was unwell, is there sort of signs and symptoms of you kind of already trying to take that man role in the house or trying to really be that person to help those around you? Or what was that period like? Because I think for so many people, we at some stage, some people have similar situations and they try to fill that role, and that, as you said, creates more pressure. What was the luck before he passed?
I definitely thought I was still doing that sort of stuff, but it got to a point where I'd wag school just so I could look after him. And then I'd be at school and I'd just be constantly worrying about him. I'd never, like, not switch off about him. And then it did lead to the, like, oh, what about mum? Like, what's mum doing? Is she going to be okay? Can she look after dad? Or what's my, like, is she going out? Does she get time for herself? Do I need to be home so she can leave and do her thing? So
it's a lot of pressure for anyone, let alone a teenage boy going through everything teenagers go through.
Yeah, definitely.
How did you and the family, and it, like, right through the illness until death, how did you guys bond well together and maybe not so well together? Because I think the listeners that may go through this or whatever might be interested to know what works for some and what doesn't work. And did you keep playing sport? Did you keep going to school? All that kind of stuff.
So when it was still sick, I was still doing my sport, involved in still family activities and stuff together. But when he passed, I completely shut off to all emotions. Just was numb, wanted to use, wanted to get away. Couldn't be in the same room as my mother because I felt that she knew what I was doing behind closed doors. And then it got to a point where I'd only go to the cemetery by myself. I thought mum needed to grieve. I needed to grieve. We can grieve opposite. When after doing all my cancelling and stuff, like, it realised that it probably would have been heaps easier to grieve together. Yeah.
What? Do you have brothers and sisters?
I got two older sisters, yeah.
How do you get along with them?
Nah, I clash so much with them, but I'll do anything for them now. Yeah,
you love them and stuff, but you clash. That's all right. You don't need to get along with your siblings, but you still love them. Yeah. Unconditional love.
Yeah.
It's like I say, I don't know if you've got a partner now, but I don't know if you guys are at this stage, but you don't always like them, but you do love them. Like, they will piss you off and they'll annoy you, but there's this unconditional love that I accept you for who you are and your flaws and stuff like that. But there's obviously, even in unconditional love, there's always conditions, which is important, and hard to have boundaries to love yourself. Through the, I guess, that period after the death, you know, how quickly did you find it took you to start spiraling, and what was, well, I guess, was there a moment there where you felt like you went left instead of right or right instead of left?
It wasn't probably until about a good 2 weeks after the funeral. Maybe, like, I think once the passing, it was all heightened, and then the funeral would kind of settled a little. But then once, like, I realized, come to terms with it, that it's actually happened, is when it just, yeah, it was just, I thought it honestly was too hard. Never come back from this. This is it. Like,
they're pretty, like, black and white statements, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like, but I guess internally, like, what does that do, like, for you, like, in that, and this might be tough, but in those moments where you're like, I can't come back from this, this is too much, this is too hard to deal with, like, is it a conscious effort to then reach to drink or go out to party or go down that path, or is it just you just do it without thinking?
I think at the start it was like, how do I get rid of this pain? And then I think, I don't know if like a, if movies or anything like that had anything to do with it, but I think then it become like, all right, that's what people do. That's what I need to do. And I think maybe seeing that a little bit more in places or movie or whatever it is, then I thought like, that's the option. That's what gets rid of the pain.
Yeah.
That's just get rid of that sorrow. But then it got to a point where I wasn't feeling any emotions. I just suppressed them. I couldn't tell you what happy or sad was, and I could be smiling on my face internally, I'll be fucked up, or vice versa. So
it's an interesting concept. And while you went through a tragedy and saw, as you said, the strongest person you knew become very vulnerable and weak and frustrated and angry, like that's a lot in itself. But what you're explaining is what a lot of men just go through in general when things essentially get harder, and we see it day to day with what we do. When things get hard for males, we shut down.
Yeah.
And we blame what's around us.
Yeah, that's definitely
easy to do. And then we go to these coping mechanisms rather than looking after ourselves, which then helps those around us. So what was there a point in this period? So we're obviously going to lead up to the offending, which ended up, doing a stint in jail. Was there a point where people were like, hey, Riley, like you need to stop doing what you're doing. You're not going down a good path. Or was it just you shut them out, or was it they just didn't see it? Or like what was that period like? Because I guess people might be experiencing this with their kids or family members or friends, and they're looking for that moment where we can potentially help them from reaching rock bottom.
I think like every possible moment there, just to, hey, how you doing? What's going on? Like it does sit there. You do realize it, but it's if you want to let that in or not. So you constantly hear it and you constantly see it, but then it's what you want to do with that information at that point in time. And 9 times out of 10, I just didn't want to hear it. Made things worse. Like, and, I always used to think like my problems were a burden on people, and I didn't want to do that. And then them saying they care is like, fuck, like they're really worried about me. Fuck this. See you later. I'm off.
So yeah. The more they tell me that, the more I feel a burden to them. But I guess now I'm going to skip over, like now looking back, are all those comments and stuff like really helpful? Like,
yeah, 100%.
Now that you know what you do.
Yeah.
So I guess to the listener, keep saying those things and finding ways to build this person up and make them feel loved and supported and cared for. Do you think if someone like sat you down, and they may have done it, and sat you down and said, like, you need to stop, would you have stopped?
It depends who it came from. If I was doing this when Dad was still around, I would have got a clip around the ear and listen straight away. I'd have pulled me head in that day. Because it all didn't come from that, I guess, role model per se, or father, or even just a father figure or something like that. If I had a bigger older brother that could have just said, hey, enough's enough now, and things may have been different. Yeah.
And I say this not in, I'm glad you went through suffering, but at the same time, what you've been through is now impacting so many other people's lives, and I know that from talking to you and stuff like that. So from 16 to 19, I'm fairly certain from one of our first conversations, you still were working through this time?
Yes, yeah, I was, yeah.
So you were what you'd call, I would say, high-functioning social partier, really?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. But so
weekends were just
a blur.
A blur.
Yeah.
From Friday to
Thursday to Sunday, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did any, that friendship group at the time, did anyone pick up that you probably needed help, or was it just what you guys did?
So probably from 16 to 18, it was more alone.
Yep.
And then, once maybe 17, 18, 19, it started being with people, around people, house parties, clubbing. And outside looking in, it's what a lot of 18-year-olds do. First turn 18, want to go out every weekend. the novelty wears off, but where the novelty never wore off because it was just numbing my pain and it was, that was the easy life.
Well, like, and I can relate to that part of it because I was the same. It was like every weekend drink.
Yeah.
And then get to 3 a.m. So, and yours might be different. So I'd be keen to know, but I'd get to like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. or Sunday at like 6 p.m. and then I'd get really suicidal and be like, I'm just not worth living now. Did you ever experience that through there, or is it, it was just literally numb, 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 work, numb, 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 work, work, work?
Yeah, pretty much. Like I never got the, so like I got to the point where like, this is fucking hard, but I subconsciously knew that I couldn't pull my mum through this.
Yeah.
In the terms of suicide and stuff like that, when what I was putting her through is probably just as fucking bad. But yeah, it's just, yeah, I could never concept that, and I didn't want her to lose a husband and then also
a son.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like that's some really good awareness, and there's probably no surprise the work you've done has led you to the point you are right now.
Yeah.
This is, I guess, firstly, thank you for sharing all of that.
No worries.
I am like, I do think you're a great person. And that's why I wanted to sit down with you and having conversations with you, and there's plenty of banter, and you're very, you are what I would say is a very gentle soul, but have had to have hardened up those edges through grief and loss and, your experiences. Looking back now, when did you think it really got bad for you?
I think once I hit 18 and then the party life opened up, which opened up an avenue to drugs, and it just, yeah, spoiled from there. But it got to it, like, I don't know how I got through working, or like we didn't have to do urines or nothing. Like it wasn't construction or nothing. Like, so it was just, yeah, cruisy as, and I think I may have like flaunted a little bit, and yeah.
We're not going to talk about the incident that led to prison, but that essentially was probably a huge turning point for you.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. It was now it's time to either, I'm going to say, man up and deal with your shit.
Yeah.
Or go down that path where people think they're manning up and they're becoming part of something different. And I don't say that in a judgmental way. I say that is because it's actually the easier option. It's easy to do. And
yeah, definitely.
That's what you did for a couple of years. And that's what I've done for many years. We all do it. So it isn't a judgment at all, but you went in and were like, I've got to make changes. Now going through, the court system, and with that comes media, and with that comes a lot of extra shit that you don't want to be dealing with, but it's the reality of the situation. How did you and your family deal with that, and what was that like for you guys?
So mum had a lot of support in the local community, because then they seen me still as that 12-year-old little Riley, cheeky little shit, just a happy-go-lucky child. So they still see me for that.
Yeah.
Mum doesn't have any social media, doesn't have a mobile phone, she's got a home phone. So,
that's great.
Yeah, it was just perfect. She didn't have to read anything or see anything. But there'll be times on the phone, like I'll be speaking to a relative or something from, or just a close friend, and they'll be like, oh, like they released an article and this is what people were saying. But then it kind of wanted me to create a shift of, all right, then that's the identity they perceive me as, and this is the identity that I want to be. And then, yeah, just created this massive shift, and I had to then work on all my underlining issues and done a lot to be where I am today now.
Well, like, I know you're not proud of your actions.
No.
And like through that period, how hard was it to come to terms with the fact that you'd done something which didn't sit well with you, and to put your hand up and go, I completely own this. I fucked up. I made an error in judgment, and I need to turn this around myself. Like, what? Because that's the hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, we can all go down a path. We all have that opportunity to go left or right. And so some of us do and some of us don't. How did you, sitting, knowing you're going to prison, going into prison, how, and do you remember the moment where things just clicked for you, where you went, I did this, I need to do the work, and I need to do it properly?
So when we become into the court systems and we're released on bail and things like that, I think it got worse. We found like little loopholes to still drink and still do this sort of stuff, and it wasn't really strict conditions. So, and then I think halfway through that, when the lawyer said like you're going to go away, he didn't say how long or nothing. I think it made it even worse again. Took it to the next level. Like, all right, then we need to go out with a bang. We're going away. Mm-hmm. And then on the bus ride to the prisons was a bit how you going, just in that closed bus by yourself. You're kind of talking through the little air vents and stuff. It was really surreal looking, all the graffiti on all the walls and stuff. And then getting to the mat, it was still a bit of a blur, like I guess coming down still, whatever. And then when I seen SMU, they said you're going to be on the next bus to Port Phillip. And then that's when it all kind of sunk in, like, fuck, this is big boy shit now. Like, and you're in, prior to going there, like I never knew what jail was. You kind of hear stories and see how hectic it is and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, once I got there, I just got into a routine and I still didn't feel like I needed to fix it. And then it was kind of just in the back. And I don't really speak much about defending because it was just like a pissing in the wind contest when you're there.
Yeah.
Who's done more bigger charges with bigger guns, bigger cars, whatever, vice versa. And then it wasn't until I got to Marganite and I was probably about almost a year into my sentence is when then I was like, fuck, like I need to change things. And at that point I was like, I was probably still about, a year and a half, 2 years away from getting out. But I was like, nah, I need to address this. Like if I get out, just going to be fucking back here again. It's going to be a revolving door. In the 3 years I did, I seen half a dozen people 4 or 5 times coming in and out. And I just didn't want to be that.
What do you remember? Do you remember the first step that you made to then make those changes? Like, what's that like in prison for people that actually want to change?
So when you get a parole sentence, you kind of get mandatory to do as programs, and then I got found not suitable for the violence program, but then I was come to terms that I need to do like drug and alcohol counseling or stuff behind that, and then. Yeah, I went and seen the program, the Karen Each down there, and said, asked pretty much how it goes. And groups wasn't my thing, so I'd end up just doing one-on-one stuff. So then I got to, I guess, get down to the real nitty-gritty stuff, that why my brain ticks and how it ticks and what causes my emotions to do this and how they work and all that.
This isn't, I guess, a question I've asked and I've probably glossed over a little bit.
Yeah.
Did you cry through the period when your dad passed away?
I didn't cry at the funeral. I cried when I got home.
Yeah.
Alone. And it was just once. They got to times where I'd fucking scream into a pillow wanting to cry. There was just no emotion. Mm. I didn't know how to attach crying to sad or crying to anger or cry like. It was just how I felt and how I reacted was two completely different things.
When you're in prison and you're going into these one-on-one sessions.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume when was the first time you cried there?
Honestly, I didn't. There was one session that I did on my dad's birthday and it was the most intense thing that I've ever done. And, I just had to sit there and I got to a point where I could have, and it was definitely a safe space. But I didn't. I just couldn't.
Yeah, you're like me. You just see it coming. You're like,
yeah.
But then, yep. Over the next period of time in prison, who are the people that really helped you make these changes? And when you started doing the work, how did your outlook on prison, but also getting out of prison, look
So people that helped put in the work, like he's still in there 12 years later. And just him and seeing how he was walking into something so young and immature, and then the man he is today.
Yep.
And I always say to myself, like I always just say that I walked into jail a 20-year-old boy, come out of jail a 23-year-old man.
Yeah.
Just like I matured heaps, I've done this, I've done that. And then as I was improving myself, I felt like I just had like another glow about me. Not that I was like invincible or anything, but I could just take on any opportunity that happened, where I used to kind of self-doubt and sort of stuff like that. But yeah, once I started working on myself, it just became second nature. Like I want to get things done. This is what I want to do. I got a new vision, a new purpose. And then I become a peer listener in jail, which is it's a pretty respected job. And yeah, essentially just get around the boys, like someone's having a rough day, go see him, what's going on, what's happening, how you doing?
Yep.
Yeah, and then I was lucky enough to come in contact with the programs manager there, Natalie Adams, that introduced me to Rodney at the time, that also worked here at some stage. He was a education coordinator. That then he linked me in with Carly Post. And from Carly Post, I met Kane. Kane coming to prison and had a conversation with me. And then from that, we created a group called the Growth Sessions in Prison, which had people from the age of 18 to 24, all different ethnicities, come from all different backgrounds. And we just created a safe space.
It's pretty incredible. Like, I guess in the short amount of time that you had the transformation you had within yourself, but then your ability to sort of give back to those that wanted help. And, like I have to be really careful with my words, because I don't judge anyone.
Yeah.
You don't judge anyone. So it's as we sort of mentioned before, sometimes it's easier to just stay in your ways, and that's okay, because that may be all you know.
Yeah.
Whereas you knew something else, and that gave you this ability.
Yeah.
What, coming out to your release point in time, you'd done a lot of work, you'd start to make a lot of ground in your own personal development. When was the first time you thought about working and family, and like what it looked like outside?
Yeah, so I always had I wanted to work, get out and get onto the rails. I just wanted to make money. That's what I want to do. I missed out on 3 years of savings, I guess. Essentially from 16 to 23, like I just missed out. I was spending all my money, just blowing it on whatever. So yeah, I just wanted to save and get into a space where I was financially stable. But then after meeting Carly, Kane, coming to Peer Listener, I spoke to Jackson Skulls as well. He was like a good mentor and said, yeah, this is what you need to study if you want to do this. And we worked out that I was going to do a cert for in mental health. Tried to kind of start it before in jail, but it was COVID and it just kept snowballing. And then I was just like, fuck it, when I get out, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Coming out now, like you've done your stint, you know, really helped yourself. What was it like just like, turning back up home, like having your mum there like properly, but also for her having her son back, like because she probably lost her son for a bit.
Yeah.
In terms of physically in jail, but also prior to going in jail, like what was that like for you guys, and how has your change impacted your relationship?
So my first visit with mum in prison was a box visit. So which was just shit. I couldn't hug her. She was bawling her eyes out. She didn't know like what was going on. And then after like maybe 3 months of being in prison, we got to a point where we could have open discussions and conversations. And this one time she was a bit off on the phone. And I said, what was wrong? And she started bawling her eyes out and said, I'm kind of glad that it was jail. She goes, I was waiting for a phone call to say that you ended up dead. And then from that, it just created a real good bond. Like we just become irresistible by then. And then, I tried to see her maybe once a month because it was still pretty hard just because she'd come in, blow her eyes out and stuff. And then it didn't get to a point where we were sitting there and, one of the older boys there come over and put her arm on mum's shoulder and said, Riley's a good kid. He's safe in here. And then that just, like, it just flicked the switch for her. She knew that I was safe. And then, yeah, all conversations to that become, like, it was just great, all opened. And then coming out, just walking back up the ramp to get inside was just mum come running out. She heard my mate's car come bolting out, tears rolling down, screaming. Just hugged me for about 5 minutes, wouldn't let me go. And I was telling her, like, I said, oh, I'm going to be late. I'm going to have to go get my bracelets. And she's like, no, just kept hugging me. She goes, they can wait. They can wait. And, yeah, just the tears of joy from my niece that lives at home with me as well. Like, so I chose not to see her throughout. She's 18 now, but she's got autism and I didn't want to put her in an environment. It was hard not to see her, and conversations on the phone were rough, but seeing her was so awesome.
Yeah. One of the conversations we had really early on when we got together was how important since being out, like having nieces and nephews. Yeah. Apologies for the cut there, guys. We had phone calls, work phone calls. So we'll wrap this up in the next 10 minutes. I guess your family, you mentioned to me, nieces and nephews have been really important for you, and like it's been a driving force for you to actually stay well and look after yourself. Like how important has it been for you?
A lot. I now wish the things that I had, that I know and have in place now, I wish I had them when I was 16. But I'm still grateful for the opportunity that I went through, because it wouldn't have led me to where I am today. And, like, I definitely don't condone my actions or anything like that, but with how I am and what I'm doing now, like, it's so good. And I think, just being now around family and connection, it kind of keeps me in check that, these are the things you lose, and these are the things that, look up to you and they want you around. And like now I just jump in the car and take my nephew to go get ice cream. Like,
yeah,
it's the greatest feeling ever.
What was it like? There's a couple of questions to finish up here. What was it like, you know, as we mentioned earlier, walking around with those bracelets, and was there any comments? And I guess to give the listeners some perspective on why you wear them.
Yeah.
And like who wears them? Because there's this preconceived idea that it's just sexual predators or pedophiles that actually wear them, when that's not the case at all.
Yeah, no, not. So when I first got them, like even before I got out, I was like, oh no, I'm going to be wearing these two fucking things. Like I was so worried about walking through a shopping center and someone grabbed their kid thinking I was that. But when I first got them, I went for lunch at a pub, and some old bloke come up to me, put his arm around me and said, I don't know what you've done. I don't care what you've done, but this is a new life now. Would you like a beer? And I told him, sorry, I can't drink. This one is an alcohol monitor. So when I was drunk of the offending, so you get an alcohol one and it just reads the sweat. And then the other one is just a tracker to see where I am. If I'm home by curfew, I had an exclusion zone. I couldn't be allowed out a certain place of the offending, which was a pub in Geelong. And then, it was just there to say, all right, I'm home by this time. I haven't been there. I haven't been associating with these sort of people. And it's just essentially just to keep you in check and, them keep tabs on you, I guess. Yeah.
It's like home prison, really.
Home arrest. Yeah.
It's one of those things. And I think knowing a little bit about the prison system, it can get quite full.
Yeah.
So these things are important, that we can get people back into the community and keep everyone safe, including themselves.
Yeah.
Now, working in this space, helping people how fulfilled and, you know, what's that? What's that like for you turning out day to day? And because it's not going off and getting this job where you get lots of money. It's not that, unfortunately, but you're giving a lot more back to the community and trying to help those that want help, really.
Yeah. So once I found that newfound purpose, like it was so great to be able to fulfill, this job, this space. Like and it all just happened. Like I finished parole, I finished studied, Kane offered me the job. Like it just was constantly just ticking over and like just felt invincible. And then coming into this space and, trying to get people and help people where I was to where I am now it's such a great feeling. It's rewarding. They're constantly giving you feedback, like, thanks for today. Like, I really enjoyed it. I needed space. I needed this or whatever. And just constantly getting reassured that you, and then it's just like, it makes me think like, fuck, like I wish I had that years ago, but it was essentially being at the time where I wanted help, which I wasn't ready.
And essentially what you're saying is it's okay to ask for help because at some point in our life, we all need it. And it's a different variables to different lengths, to different times, to different methods. We all need it at some point. Like none of us get through this thing we call life unscathed.
Yeah.
But putting your hand up and asking for help yourself and now seeing others do that, it's really impactful. Is there any messages you'd like to share before we wrap this up?
No, not really. I think we've covered a lot. More just, I guess, not awareness, but you see ankle bracelets, like, you don't need to stare at them. They're already feeling uncomfortable with mine. Like, I would never wear shorts in public when I was with my mother.
Yeah.
Out of respect for her, because it was more so not the looks I get, the looks that people get walking with that person as well. And yeah, I guess it's just creating something around that. Just you see them, you know what, you've seen them. You probably read the article in the paper. You don't need to keep staring at them. Let them be.
I just want to thank you, not just for chatting about all of this stuff, but really opening up my eyes to a different side of things that I don't understand. I really do appreciate it. I look forward to working with you for years to come.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Power, Strength and Vulnerability, the Mental Health Podcast. If anything in this podcast has brought up difficult feelings, please call Lifeline on 13 1144. For any further information, or if you want to bring your story to life, contact Shane at shane@vitalityfit.com.au. That's VITALITYFITT.com.au.